Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello, and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this edition, Professor Jeremy Black, whose books on the period include Waterloo and the forthcoming The French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, Strategies for a World War, talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about why and how Europe was engulfed in wars with France between 1792 and 1815.
Professor Jeremy Black, particularly perhaps in Britain, often when we refer to the Napoleonic Wars, we're really thinking of the succession of stop-start conflicts that went on between France, Britain, and many other European nations from the 1790s right through to 1815. There's a difference, obviously, between what we call the French Revolutionary Wars and the various wars that follow, various coalitions allying against France. Can you perhaps unpick briefly the different phases of the French Revolutionary and the Napoleonic Wars?
Yes, the French Revolutionary Wars began in 1792 with essentially Prussia and Austria against France, broadened out in 1793 with a broader coalition against France, including Britain, Spain, and the Dutch. And then, as you correctly say, went through a lot of different iterations. For example, Prussia left the First Coalition in 1795, as did Spain, but whereas Prussia then remained neutral, Spain, for example, the following year joined in on the French side. So in terms of the opponents of France, there are a series of coalition wars. In terms of France, one would usually distinguish between the French Revolutionary Wars, which ended from this point of view in 1799, with the Napoleon coming to power. He seizes power in late 99, and you would usually call them the Napoleonic Wars from then on, a series of wars that themselves were not continuous, because in 1802, 1803, between the Treaty of Amiens with Britain in 1802 and the resumption of war between the two powers in 1803, there was briefly a period of no conflict. War was then continuous with at least one power, Britain, until Napoleon was overthrown in 1814. And with his return in 1815, you have the last of the Napoleonic Wars.
Good. Well, that's very clear, just to set out the chronology of conflict. One point which I would like to ponder is, did the French Revolution create a fundamentally new ideological raison d'etre for war, or do you see continuities with previous 18th century European conflicts?
Oh, well, this is a very interesting question, and one indeed in which in a number of books I have engaged. First of all, in terms of ideology, I argued in a book on Europe from 1550 to 1800, and indeed in a more specific work, that there was, in a sense, a recurrence of a previous ideological period of struggle, namely that of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. And the point about underlining that is to suggest a rhythmic quality, or at least a recurrence of themes, as opposed to those people that try and find some abrupt entry into modernism. And I think one could take that further if you argue that much of the opposition to the French Revolution derived at least in part from religious commitment, as indeed had happened obviously with the Wars of the Reformation, and indeed if you could present the French Revolution itself as having a quasi-religious or ideologically committed of that type, millenarian character. Now, in terms of your second question, which is, in effect, is there a new type of war here? The answer, no. A number of academics have tried to argue that. I'm afraid their works simply reflect a lack of knowledge of pre-revolutionary French warfare. The idea that there was in some way a limited warfare prior to 1792 is mistaken. the idea that the French revolutionary forces were as it were, paradigm shift towards a new intensity or effectiveness of warfare is also mistaken. And as you will know from my works on the period, I argue very clearly that what actually emerges from the French Revolution in Napoleonic period is the resilience and adaptability of ancien regime warfare, and more particularly at sea in the case of Britain and on land in the case of Russia. I mean, you know, the people who sort of try and argue for a new age of warfare never satisfactorily explain why the French were defeated.
In the early phases, so the period up to 1799, but before Napoleon really takes charge, is it really a conflict, a grudge between Paris and Vienna with other allies like Prussia brought in, or is that too simplistic?
Well, I mean, any uniform account of a conflict which has a multiplicity of elements could always be regarded as simplistic. I mean, there's always a difficulty of summarizing what is a great variety of goals and means. I mean, for example, Austrian intentions do not explain British policy. So no, I wouldn't say that that is the only theme. And I would also draw attention to different drives in Austrian policy, different priorities. Should Austria be more concerned about its relationship, often complex and often tense, with both Russia and Prussia, and more particularly in the age of the second and third coalitions of Poland? And is that a more serious challenge? And there are been a number of good books on Austrian foreign policy in this period. And I think it's fair to say, for example, for those who read English, there's a book by Karl Reuter on Baron Tugio, who's one of the leading Austrian ministers of the 1790s. And it's very much drawing the attention to the tensions in Austrian policymaking. And you won't be surprised to hear, and here you can look at works by people like Michael Duffy or the late Piers Mackesy, that there are similar in other powers. And in their case, they focused more particularly on Britain.
And when we look at this earlier phase, I mean, why is it the French aren't defeated? They have this coalition against them, particularly in the period before, we'll come to the quality of Napoleon's generalship in a bit, but before that phase, what do we attribute the French ability to hold out against all comers?
Well, I wouldn't say they weren't defeated. I would say they weren't crushed. I mean, Günter Rottenberg, in his study of the Austrian army in the 1790s, argued that the Austrians won as many battles as the French did, and French attempts to sustain a presence east of the Rhine are thwarted on a number of occasions. So I think one's got to be a bit more cautious there. And it's also worth pointing out that in the War of the Second Coalition, at the end of the 1790s, the French are put under enormous pressure. After all, Napoleon fails in Egypt. The French don't do terribly well in Italy, Switzerland, and Germany. So I think one's got to be cautious here. There is a difference between not being crushed and not being necessarily successful.
Perhaps you could remind many listeners what Napoleon was really doing in Egypt. What was the purpose of that expedition?
Well, I think you would be fair to say that a number of French commentators of the period would have been quite sceptical as to what the purpose of that expedition was. You are entitled to ask. As you know, I've written on a number of books on this period, and I'm afraid to say I would tend to argue that Napoleon's basic concerns were rather similar to those of Julius Caesar in invading England, or what we would later call England, a desire to maintain control of an army, a determination to accrue prestige, a vainglorious tendency, which of course led him to consider himself, this is Napoleon, as a kind of modern day Alexander the Great. In terms of vague ideas he enunciated of hitting Britain's position in India, that was just folly in terms of the potential of a presence in Egypt. And of course, he actually helped to gravely weaken France, both in terms of the major destruction of the French Mediterranean fleet at the Battle of the Nile, the Battle of Abiquiu Bay by Horatio Lord Nelson, and also, of course, by taking an army to Egypt and then not being able to bring it back. So in many senses, this was crass folly.
Mm. We often see Napoleon's promotion, or the promotion of Napoleon is envisaged sometimes as a sign of, you know, the revolution opening France's armed forces out to talent. Is that overstated? What was the way in which the army operated fundamentally different after the revolution to during the Ancien Régime?
Well, that again is an interesting question. I mean, first of all, talent was obviously compromised by political factors. You could be as talented as you liked and of any social background as you liked, but if you failed to toe both the combination of the political line and the political factionalism, changing political factionalism and the revolution, you could be out. And as you will know, a number of generals and admirals, a large number went into exile, a number were executed, a number were imprisoned. The revolution devoured its own, a process that continued under Napoleon. If you mean, are its social politics different? Yes, I think it's clear that under the Ancien Régime, social connections that were significant were different to the social connections or political connections that were significant in the revolutionary period. But I think the idea that that therefore meant an openness to talent is laughable. It's rather like saying that because the social composition of the Soviet army was different to that of the Romanov army, therefore it was a sort of, you know, one that was, again, open to talent. I mean, that would have been laughable to generals who were shot under Stalin. Mm-hmm.
And, well, as we come to the period after 1799, I want to ask about the role of Napoleon and his marshals, because whatever our views of Napoleon as a general is, I mean, he's surrounded by a number of marshals whose name, even if you're not French, you know, you can still remember now, even if you're not a specialist on the period, some very significant generals and marshals. To what extent was Napoleon responsible for identifying these talents, or were they coming up through the ranks anyway, and it's not a matter of seeing Napoleon as the source of all preferment and judgment in these matters?
Well, I wouldn't. I have to tell you, I don't go as strongly as you do towards a eulogistic view of the French army in that period. And I would say that, as I've just argued, that some of the most talented French commanders, Moreau, for example, the victor at Hohenlinden, you know, his career is destroyed by the political situation. Napoleon is without a doubt jealous of him, and he ends up, as you probably know, fighting for and being killed as a result for France's opponents. So no, I'd be a little wary about this. I think that there is in the Napoleonic regime a kind of gimcrack new aristocracy, rather similar to that you get under the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about Britain and its role. I mean, do you see British involvement as a war of choice, or really were British fundamental issues of sovereignty and its own autonomy, severely compromised by Paris, and for which, therefore, British interests were almost as strong as Prussian or Austrian interests.
Well, Britain goes to war in early 1793, essentially over the independence of the United Provinces, the Netherlands. Clearly, the ideological background, concern about a republican regime which is about to execute its king, is a significant factor. But it needs to be said that earlier in 1792, in the summer and spring of 1792, the government of William Pitt the Younger had very much emphasized that it would not get involved in the French Revolutionary War. It had very much, as it were, argued down what was seen as the somewhat hysterical arguments by Edmund Burke. So I would argue that there was no inevitability about British presence, just as it's worth bearing in mind that in 1791, Britain had gone to war with Russia in the Ochakov crisis, in 1790, nearly gone to war with Spain in the Nootka Sound crisis, in 1787, nearly gone to war with the French in the Dutch crisis. And in each case, circumstances and contingencies had ensured that that did not happen. But I think it's fair to say that the process by which those who wished to avoid war on both sides were unable to define and pursue a process of conciliation in the winter of 92 to 93 is significant. I wouldn't say it's inevitable, but I think it's significant. There were immediate issues at stake, which the French found that they could, and the French political system much more divided than the British one at that point, that the French found that they could not or would not compromise over. And given that the United Provinces was Britain's major ally, I think that was a crucial development.
Mm-hmm. We're often led to believe that one of Britain's major roles was really as the banker for the various anti-French coalitions. And of course, fighting very seriously at sea, fighting very seriously in the Peninsular Wars, and then obviously in the Hundred Days. But for large periods, is actually the role of financial supplier Britain's primary contribution?
I think it's an important contribution, but I would actually say that, not the only contribution. I mean, the very fact that Britain is the world's leading naval power is very important in terms of the options available to France. It ensures that Britain can maintain a presence in the Mediterranean. It limits France's ability to use the oceans themselves. I mean, France, and once it's allied to Spain and once it's overcome the Dutch, have a formidable naval power projection. So that is also significant.
So that brings us to the subject of the Royal Navy. Sometimes we look at things from the perspective of the two world wars in the 20th century and Britain needing to import foods and raw materials to keep the country as an island going. Was that true to the same extent in the first years of the 19th century, or was the British economy much more self-sufficient, therefore much less dependent on needing the Royal Navy to secure merchant supplies to come in?
While as yet there hadn't been the very large population growth you see in the 19th and early 20th century, nevertheless, Britain already was in a situation that it was dependent on food imports. That was important. And its economy was a trading economy. And on top of that, the Navy was required to provide the security of the British Isles, Ireland, as well as the other parts of Britain, the United Kingdom, from the prospect of invasion. So I would say the Navy is very, very important and in relative terms, more significant than, shall we say, in World War One or two, because in World War Two you also have the air dimension, and in World War One, of course, there is a larger British commitment to land warfare on the European continent.
Was Napoleon really serious about invading Britain, do you think? You know, the barges being assembled around Boulogne, was that a feint, or was it for real?
No, that was for real. And at the time when he was assembling those forces, he wasn't at war with Austria, or still less Prussia, or Russia. And therefore, Britain was his major goal. I mean, I think it's worth bringing out that the French revolutionaries prior to Napoleon seizing power, the French revolutionaries had themselves both attempted invasions of Ireland and, on a much smaller scale, had actually landed a force in Pembrokeshire. So this wasn't new with Napoleon, but the force he deploys near Boulogne, an extensive force, is very much intended for an invasion of Britain, and he is strongly interested in that as a proposition. And in many senses, the War of the Third Coalition is initially, from the French point of view, a knockout war against Britain. It's subsequently, because of factors that Napoleon has only a limited control over, very limited control over, swells into a far larger war, one that in fact involves more powers against him than had been involved in the War of the Second Coalition, when Prussia had been neutral, or the First Coalition, when Russia had been neutral.
So in Britain, we see the Battle of Trafalgar as a battle of liberation, which frees Britain from the likelihood of imminent invasion. Is that how Napoleon would have interpreted Trafalgar?
Not quite. I mean, the French-Spanish fleet that leaves Cadiz in 1805 is not, in fact, seeking to invade Britain. By then, because of Austria coming into the war, French policy has changed. Napoleon has shelved his plan to invade Britain. The Grande Armée has marched east into southern Germany, on a campaign that's to lead via the victory at Ulm to victory at Austerlitz and the knocking out of Austria. And the invasion fleet, in fact, is heading, the Franco-Spanish invasion fleet is in fact heading for Naples. But the practicality is that this is the main strike fleet of the alliance against Britain, and although its immediate intention is not to invade Britain, its eventual intention was certainly in that direction.
Mm-hmm. So let's turn our gaze back to the European continent. We're talking a moment ago about the British financing of the coalitions. How did Napoleon finance his own war machine?
Well, to a considerable extent by expropriation, to a considerable extent, and the French revolutionaries did the same, conquest fed conquest. I've recently brought out a history of logistics, which is deliberately intended as a different account to that, the standard account, the Martin van Krefeld account. And I'm much more wary of the kind of modernizing approach to logistics. I think the process of, as it were, extortion, expropriation, and looting remains very important quite late in history. In some parts of the world, it's still important. And if you're thinking of the French, I mean, considerable amount of their military resources comes from, including of manpower, not as well as supplies, comes from areas they've conquered and overawed that are either absorbed into the new French state, which is much expanded under first the revolutionaries and then Napoleon, or under sort of pliant allies. So I think in many senses, this is a, Napoleon in many senses, despite the presentation of him as a modern figure, is in many senses rather in the long tradition of warlords.
We were talking earlier about Napoleon and his role with appointing marshals, and also to what extent promotion in the French army was driven by ideology as much or more than talent. I wonder the Bourbonist French, the people at all levels of society who are fundamentally still loyal to the France of the Ancien Régime, what their attitude really was whilst these wars were going on. Did they find themselves drawn into the notion of La Patrie and Napoleon is nevertheless a glorious figure who was reasserting French power? Or was there always a very significant, almost in Napoleon's eyes, like a fifth column of French people who were actively subverting rather than just lying low?
I think both elements can be found. I mean, first of all, Napoleon, it hadn't begun with Napoleon. The Directory government pulls back from many of the excesses associated with Jacobin and the Terror. But with Napoleon, the process is taken further in that direction. There's the reintroduction of slavery. There's the conciliation with the Catholic Church, albeit one which is very much under Napoleon's thumb. There is a degree of creation of a new imperial aristocracy in which favoured members of the old system can get a role. But I think it's fair to say that a fair number of Bourbon figures, including obviously the Bourbon claimant to the throne, and his heir, are abroad. And I think that is a significant factor. Napoleon is never the legitimist figure. There are always many French who don't see him in that light. I mean, he desperately tries to legitimate himself in the European terms by getting rid of his first wife and marrying the Russian he wants to marry into, doesn't succeed there, so marrying into the Austrian Habsburg imperial line. Ironically, with Napoleon, of course, there is both a rejection of him from legitimist Bourbons, but there is also a rejection of him from Republicans. Napoleon is the man that has destroyed the revolution, not least by crowning himself emperor. And, of course, as you probably know, there are Republican conspiracies against him. So I think Napoleon's support is quite narrow. When things go wrong, there is nobody really to stand for him in 1814. And in 1815, once he's been defeated at Waterloo, the whole thing falls to pieces. And again, the comparison with some of the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century is instructive.
Was there a limit to Napoleon's ambitions?
No. And there was a fundamental lack of reality, or what our American cousins would call situational awareness. I think there was a lack of situational awareness in all sorts of respects. And I think he is strategically extraordinarily naive. I mean, there is a lot of effort to praise Napoleon's generalship, but I would argue, I've got a book forthcoming called The French Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars, Strategies for a World War. I would argue that however operationally successful he could be, strategically, he makes repeated mistakes.
So would you see him as better, in soldiering terms, better as a battlefield tactician than as a geopolitical or at any rate, continental strategist?
Yes, I think that's a very fair assessment.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about one of his greatest strategic errors, the invasion of Russia. Was it necessary? Why did he do it?
It wasn't necessary. He did it because Tsar Alexander is not going in his direction as far as policy is concerned. And Napoleon, like Hitler, in fact, subsequently, finds it very, very difficult to cope with people who don't do what he wants. And in fact, what this does is helps to take him into conflict, just as with Hitler with America in 1941, into conflicts which weren't actually inevitable or necessary. I mean, Russia is not happy with France's attempt impose the continental system, the economic blockade of Britain, which Napoleon had enunciated in 1806. He's very dissatisfied about that, and to Napoleon, that is a serious breach. The Russians distrust Napoleon over the future of Poland. But the practicality is that it's Napoleon's insistence on obedience and his treatment of allies as servants that is the real problem.
Mm-hmm. So is it really, is it fair to say that Napoleon just didn't know when to stop because ultimately his power rested on military glory, and so if he stopped pursuing military glory, he ceased to have legitimacy for his own regime?
Well, that's one way of looking at it, but he didn't need to engage in that war. Alexander I did not wish to fight him. And it's worth bearing in mind, Alexander was already engaged in war with the Turks, from 1806 to 1812, which was and a serious war. So Alexander I did not wish to fight Napoleon. Napoleon did not need to engage in that war to maintain his gloire. Britain, he was engaged in war with. War with Britain could be contained on land in the peninsula as long as Napoleon was able to reinforce his forces there. There was no threat of conflict with Austria or Prussia in 1812. Austria and Prussia, in fact, only come in again against him because the Russian conflict has gone wrong. So, no, I think it was a major failure on Napoleon's part that comes from his psychological inability to cope with people who won't do what he wants.
How good were the major commanders on the anti-French side? Who would you assess were very effective, and which were the duds?
Oh well, I think Prince Charles was very good on for the Austrian side. I think Suvorov for the Russians was an excellent general. I think Wellington is an excellent general. I think that the opponents of France have some good generals, obviously in the British case, excellent admirals. I think there are obviously difficulties for the anti-French side in, as it were, becoming a side. I mean, because there are disparate goals, both in long term and in short term, between the opponents of France, between Austria and Russia, between Austria and Prussia, between Britain and Austria, between Britain and Russia. All of those are, I think, very significant. And it shows how appallingly incompetent Napoleon is, that he actually is able to overcome, on behalf of his opponent, the divisions between the latter.
After the retreat from Moscow, are we really looking at the French war machine with a broken back? I mean, there's the Battle of Leipzig and the various defensive wars getting closer to Paris. Napoleon fighting these rearguard actions. Is he staving off the inevitable by then, or should we look at these as a series of tactical decisions which could have gone either way if they played out differently?
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, the first thing to bear in mind is it wasn't inevitable. The Austrians in particular did not wish to see Napoleon overthrown. They wished to see him limited, but not overthrown. And Napoleon repeatedly, as it were, snubs attempts to produce peace. Rejects conciliatory terms. So in the grand strategic terms, no, Napoleon opts for continued conflict, and that helps to, in particular, anger Metternich, who the Austrian Chancellor, who does not really want to ally with the Russians and the Prussians and does not really want to fight so that the war can end on terms that are going to suit the British. And I think that's a terrible failure on Napoleon's part. I mean, France itself also is running out of support for him. As I've already argued, the support was always a bit conditional. But you see in 1813 and even more 1814 and even more 1815, a disinclination to serve. You see fewer people coming forward in the conscript classes. These are major problems for Napoleon. And obviously push back onto the defensive. He also does not find it so possible to raise supplies by extorting them from areas that he's conquered or from allies.
And Napoleon's failure to build on the leads of, you know, separating the different war aims of his opponents, failing to pick up semi-olive branches offered particularly from Austria, who, as you say, would have been prepared to keep him in power, albeit a constrained power. This failure to make the most of his remaining options just comes from a pigheadedness, or what was he calculating?
Well, I think a lot of it is pigheadedness. I mean, I think he is hoping, as he hopes again in 1815, that the alliance, and indeed as Hitler does in 1945 and 44, hoping that the alliance against him will collapse. But my own view is that he was instinctively unwilling to accept limits or half measures, that represents a loss of touch with reality. I would say that, you know, he has an inherent optimism, a temperamental opportunism. And that's in effect often seen in an operational duplicity, but it's no substitute for strategy. There's neither pragmatism there nor rationality. So it's not new to Napoleon as a result at this stage. It's been a consistent characteristic, but, you know, it becomes more serious in the context that he himself has created by forcing Russia into war with him.
So he's forced to abdicate in 1814, sent to Elba, famously escapes from Elba, and we have the extraordinary denouement of 1815 with the 100 Days campaign. It's extraordinary campaign. I mean, a real kind of gambler's throw of the dice, or could it have turned out well for him?
Well, you know, I've got to declare an interest there. I've published a book on Waterloo, which includes a discussion of strategy. I don't think it could have turned out well for him. I think that even if he had been more successful in Belgium, I think the weight of the forces coming in from on his eastern frontier, the Austrians and the Russians, was too great. I think, I mean, it's a classic example of his strategy of risk, expediency and self-belief. What he was trying to do, of course, is to engage in sequential victory, you know, rather like Germany tried again in 1914-15 and tried again in 1940-41. But the room for manoeuvre he has is limited. His support within France is limited. He has united the other powers against him. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that before he returned from Elba, relations between, on the one hand, Russia and Prussia, and on the other hand, Austria, backed up by Louis XVIII of France and by Britain, over the fate of Saxony was so dire that Russia and Prussia and Austria had been thinking of fighting each other. That all goes out the window as soon as the news arrives at the Congress of Vienna that Napoleon's back. They all resolve to put aside their differences, to raise an enormous force, and to deal with him. And, you know, if you look at Napoleon's belief that he could peel off the alliance against him, it's based on a real lack of reality. You know, the notion that the Whigs in Britain were going to succeed in overthrowing the government of the Earl of Liverpool is just a fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Well, my last question is as much a political one as a military one. As the Napoleonic Wars end in 1815 with the final defeat at Waterloo, Western Europe then has decades of peace, much greater level of peace than it's known for many of the previous centuries. Is that period of peace attributable to the Napoleonic Wars or to other factors? I suppose I'm asking, was Europe so exhausted by the Napoleonic Wars it didn't want to repeat anything on that scale again, or actually there could easily have been a succession of other wars and the Napoleonic Wars, it didn't really have a legacy of relative peace in the decades that followed.
That's interesting. I mean, there are, in fact, you know, if you look at my book on 19th century warfare, there are, in fact, conflicts. I mean, in Italy, in Belgium, in Spain, there are conflicts in the 1820s and 30s. You're right, they're not on the scale of the French Revolution and Napoleonic Wars. But I wouldn't put it quite like that. And again, I'm very chary of seeing an inevitability. And it's worth looking back and saying that, okay, Britain, France, Spain fought during the War of American Independence, but they didn't fight on the European mainland, apart from a siege of Gibraltar. There'd been no significant conflict in Western Europe between 1763 and the outbreak of the French Revolutionary Wars. So that's prior to the French Revolutionary Wars. I would be a bit loath to make a overarching interpretation like that. I would say that the major powers, both prior to 1792 and after 1815, are able to conduct international relations and their own foreign policies without going in for a large-scale conflict. I do not think that's because they couldn't have afforded such a conflict. I think actually, in some respects, it's because they were run by politicians who could appreciate, including them obviously preeminently rulers, who could appreciate the need for restraint and could understand, as Napoleon never could understand, the difference between being irritated, having interests to pursue, and risking war. And Napoleon could never do that. But obviously, Napoleon, in my view, was a really very third-rate figure.
Well, on that, Professor Jeremy Black has written extensively on the period of the Napoleonic Wars and the French Revolutionary Wars. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.